our ancestors who lived out in the bush and didn't know if a stick in the road might be a snake, and so they assumed it's a snake. And so we've had that survival mechanism still, you know, hardwired into our nature. And so given a pandemic, it's not just an epidemic, but it's a pandemic, meaning it is common to every person we're going to see, even if they're in denial about it, that their denial is maybe their response, then it's important to counterbalance the you know, the fear, the anger, and the shutting downness of denial, to just counterbalance it with our natural joie de vivre, our natural joy of being alive.
Author, translator, editor, and poet Gary Gock joins John and Scoop in this edition of the Plutopia News Network podcast. We discuss the Buddhist tradition and meditation in the time of COVID-19 and much more.
Welcome to the Plutopia podcast. Today, returning for a second engagement, our mindfulness mentor, Gary Gock, author of Pause, Breathe, Smile, Awakening Mindfulness When Meditation Is Not Enough. When is meditation not enough, Gary?
The subtitle came from a talk on the well when I was trying to figure out how to say that what people are calling mindfulness today is not really only just a tool, but a way, you know, something that's 24/7. And people have the common notion they go to mindfulness so they can learn meditation as something that they can do and then stop. You know, it's like, okay, I've meditated now. My 20 minutes are up. And now I can go back to being, you know,
mindless.
Yeah. I don't think the subtitle said that, but at the time when I was trying to get it, you know, into the pipeline, that's how it came out.
Yeah, I've always thought it was interesting. I mean, we call it practice.
Yeah.
That means we're practicing, but you don't practice and then just practice. When you practice, you carry your practice forward into other things. And in this case, you can carry the practice into your everyday life.
One thing I noticed to my horror is advertising has discovered mindfulness. And I was walking through the room. My wife was watching some program on television, and up comes a ad for Mindful Mint. And I'm just like, what? It's like, I don't remember reading that.
Calm ad. There's an app called Calm.
Yes.
A smartphone app, yeah.
Yes, Gary, when are you going to get your app?
That's a billion-dollar business, guys.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I need a syndicate. I need a cartel.
I actually, let's see, the app that I tried was Headspace. I did a number of meditations, like the first 10 or 20 meditations were free, and they were like introductory. Mm. And at the time I did that, I had lapsed for some weeks, and I thought that might be an interesting way to get back into it. Plus, I was just interested in what the app would do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was good guided meditations. Past a certain point, it seemed less useful, but I can see how people are making use of things like Headspace and Calm and so forth.
I never made it past the Pokemon app.
I belong to the Plum Village tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, and there's a Plum Village app, and I'm sure it's very good. I just don't have a smartphone, for one thing. And I kind of I try to be on the natch, as they say.
Yeah.
You know, but I just talked to a guy. He hadn't been on Facebook. I couldn't find him on Facebook. I said, "Are you good?" He said, "Yeah, we just got married." So I said, "Congratulations." And, you know, yeah. And I said, "You know, I guess you'll post, you know, wedding pictures and honeymoon pictures on Facebook, but I can't find your page." He says, "I got rid of all my social media and I'm so much happier."
Yeah. You know, that's very interesting.
It's not the well. I mean, the well is my go-to social media. But
well, it's hard to
the idea of, go ahead. I talked
about it. Oh, I was just going to say, it's hard to be mindful if you're continually distracted by things that are happening in social media, which are sometimes, at least for me, I find myself getting into some contentious discussions with people who seem to be, they're not particularly fact-based in their thinking.
Yeah.
And you know, I try not to be obnoxious, but I say, well, you know, actually, here's the facts.
Yeah, the three sides of a triangle are 180 degrees.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right.
2 and 2 is 4. Well, social media is certainly problematic, and I found myself thinking about foregoing all of it as well, though it's hard to do. You know, it's hard.
Well, it's part of your livelihood, though.
It's part of mine, too. And everybody I know, not everybody, but most of the people that I know and have known for a while interact via social media. And I certainly have a more active social life than I would otherwise have. Anyway,
I guess for me, the hurdle is the smartphone, which I think most people use for social media. They use the social media on a smartphone. Maybe they don't, but not having a smartphone is more of an issue. I like not having a smartphone. I would like also not to have all the social media I do, but I do. So it's kind of a compromise, I guess.
Well, the smartphone is a little more addictive, I think, than I mean, if you're just doing social media through a computer, it's not quite the same thing. But somebody pointed out to me that the Facebook, the way it scrolls on a smartphone is sort of like a slot machine. And then it's really set up that way to sort of just suck you in, to just keep you scrolling, you know. Just
Instagram does that. When I log into Instagram, there's all these faces, and then three of them switch real fast, like a slot machine. That's interesting. So I got a question. Out in Texas, do you find this phenomenon that I do? I don't have a car, so I walk. And when I walk, the people who don't wear masks and who walk down the middle of the sidewalk are people talking to an invisible virtual friend on their smartphone. And they don't see you.
And they may have like pods in their ears or something like that.
Have you noticed this?
I see that from time to time. I saw that this morning. I will say that in the neighborhood where I live, where I walk quite a bit, and where I encounter a lot of other people walking, people aren't wearing masks, but supposedly just for exercise, when you're out walking, as long as you keep distance, you don't need the mask. But I rarely run across somebody who's actually engaged in a smartphone conversation or seems distracted to that extent. People seem to be sort of enjoying the day, really. I mean, it's a beautiful neighborhood.
My smartphone is suing me for non-support because when I only use it when I go somewhere and almost never even then, I just leave it plugged into the wall and ignore it. And, I don't miss it. In my neighborhood out in the country, none of the squirrels and deer have any smartphones, so I haven't noticed that exercising and talking thing out here.
Right.
Well, the thing that we,
birds
Gary and
don't
I had,
need Twitter to tweet.
Well, Gary and I
can't stop them.
Email exchanges prior to today, and we were going to talk about the pandemic.
That's
and
right.
Especially how the pandemic relates to like mindfulness and equanimity and some of the practices and concepts of Buddhism that you find within Buddhism and that you find within meditation traditions. And Gary, I know that you have thought about and have written about equanimity in the COVID era. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about coping in a time of particular anxiety over potential illness and death and over isolation and over all the things that we're experiencing now.
So thank you. I did publish something that is Plutopians can find either through a link in this podcast or by going to my homepage or something. It was I put it out to the Buddhist community and Lion's Roar picked it up. And what I had done essentially, you know, I don't really write to tell people what I know. It's more to see what I think. And in, I think it was February, when the pandemic was first, you know, in our awareness, I had a night where I was laying on my back in bed. And I had difficulty breathing. And I practice full awareness of breathing, hopefully. I mean, that's sort of the link for my practice being 24/7, because my lungs, you know, they do their thing 20,000 times a day without my having to will an in-breath or an out-breath. And it was strange. I just could not fill my lungs. And so the human brain being wired for negativity, bias, or, you know, fear, and so forth, said, well, maybe this is it, Gary. Your number's up. You know, tough luck, kid. No more subscriptions to the New Yorker or whatever. And I didn't feel overwhelming panic. I didn't feel, you know, like, oh my God, did I turn off the stove? You know, fear, panic kind of reactions. It was more like I recognized that I was feeling it in terms of, was seeing it in terms of equanimity. The idea that, or the view that sees things as they are, you know, things as they is, which is how the Japanese Zen master Suzuki Roshi would put it. He'd say, things as they is. And he knew English well enough, by the way. So he just kind of making that point. You know, things as it is. You just like that. And when we add to it this extra head on top of the head, that's where we get all, you know, wound up and bound up. That's the basic. The basic Buddhist outlook, you know, the noble truths are four, but they're boiled down to two. One is that the way we're wired as human beings, we're set up to suffer. And by recognizing that, we can liberate ourselves from a lot of needless suffering for ourselves and others. So from that point, I started taking equanimity practice, you know, as my COVID practice for myself and others. And I'll add that monitoring for my Hep C, which is gone, knock wood. I wasn't a user, but I tried a drug once and had Hep C and got cured. They found a lump. And same thing. It was like, oh, they found a lump. I might die. But right now, it's a good day. It's a beautiful day. The sky is, wow, look at that. It's blue. Who would have thought that they would have come up with that color like that? You know, so in a nutshell, equanimity doesn't mean indifference. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean, rather, it's more about inclusivity. And that takes me out of my small view, what Alan Watts called the skin-encapsulated ego. That equanimity really can be inclusive of everything. And when I'm viewing and living life fully that way, then when a crisis occurs, such as we're still experiencing, it's like I can be ready to act if I need to, but from a place of calm. And that in the midst of emergencies, I remain calm. And then I guess just to dot an I or cross a T in equanimity or being equanimous. Huh? It doesn't mean all things are equal. Huh? Being inclusive recognizes that I'm human and that I have this negativity bias that my brain has inherited from our ancestors who lived out in the bush and didn't know if a stick in the road might be a snake, and so they assumed it's a snake. And so we've had that survival mechanism still, you know, hardwired into our nature. And so given a pandemic, it's not just an epidemic, but it's a pandemic, meaning it is common to every person we're going to see, even if they're in denial about it, that their denial is maybe their response, then it's important to counterbalance the, you know, the fear, the anger, and the shutting downness of denial, to just counterbalance it with our natural joie de vivre, our natural joy of being alive. And if I were to drop dead in the middle of a Zoom podcast, well, that would be an interesting way to go. But I won't yet. But my point is that, you know, I prefer not to do so. But I'm aware that in the nature of what is, when I step out of my own way, that, you know, that is possible. And so with the COVID kind of sword of Damocles hanging over my head because I'm over 70, and so I'm in what somebody in the well called the death demo, I gotta do my part doubly to make sure that I don't get it and that I don't transmit it to others.
I think
so. You know, there's probably more in the article. I'm just sort of doing this from memory about how I've adopted equanimity as my practice. And just if I may cross the T, and then I'm done. The equanimity in this isn't something you get in in the mindfulness as a tool. This is mindfulness as part of the Buddhist way, or, you know, an Eastern way of being and living and seeing and doing. And it comes from a Hindu philosophy. And when the Buddha was asked about God, he didn't say anything. He wouldn't talk about the afterlife or God, or he didn't even talk about mind body. There were things that just said, you know, he would not open his mouth about. But for people who were, and also because his teachings aren't really dependent one way or another on a creator deity. They, you know, you can bring your own if that's what you're interested in. But for people who had devotion to a sense of a divine Godhead, if you will, he taught four practices that are called Brahma Viharas, that Brahma God Vihara dwelling, divine dwellings, or if you're secular, immeasurable abodes. And well, the Tibetans and the Zen kind of differ as to an order, if there is an order to them. But typically in Zen, it starts with loving kindness, metta, compassion, karuna, sympathetic joy, mudita, and the highest being, upekkha, which is translated as equanimity or inclusivity. So patience is a great virtue. It's like perfection of virtue. Equanimity is like a couple of orders of magnitude greater.
So you made me think of a great story about Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, who got cancer and ultimately died from cancer. And when he first got sick, they thought he might have something that was infectious, that was contagious, so they isolated him. And when they finally decided that he wasn't contagious, when they determined he had cancer, they let him see people again. And I think it was Richard Baker went inside, and Suzuki Roshi looked at him and said, "I have good news. It's only cancer." Meaning, I can see you now. I can be with people again because I'm not contagious. I only have cancer.
I didn't know that story. It's great.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. It reminds me somewhat of Native American teachings. My grandmother was Choctaw, and she grew up in Indian territory before it was Oklahoma. Was educated at the Indian Girls School, and I spent summers with her, and she would teach me little lessons about the Choctaw way. The most impressive one was she taught me how to hold a handful of sand, and she, I'm a stupid little, you know, 6 or 8 year old kid. I just grab a handful of sand, squeeze it really hard, and it goes shooting out both sides of my fist. And she gently takes her two hands, lifts up the sand, as she says, and it will stay here all day. So my little mind went, that was actually smart. And they had so many you think of the Indians, they're out shooting bows and arrows and killing people, but it's a very gentle culture, the Choctaw. Yeah. And her husband, my grandfather, had died recently. And I asked her if she worried about dying. She said, "I only worry about who's going to care for my garden."
Beautiful.
So,
I don't think anyone has a lock on these traditions of wisdom. I think that although they exist in the West, we often go to other sources than the Western canon. because from the Renaissance through the technological revolution, they kind of got ossified. But the truth is kind of everywhere. Yeah.
You had shared with me some pieces by Giorgio Agamben.
Who? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, talking about things like the collapse of faith in this time. What was it he said? He said, how could it happen that without being aware of it, an entire country has been ethically and politically collapsed in the face of a sickness? And the question yeah. about, you know, the essential human desire or need to be social and to be with each other, and how that's contradicted by the isolation that is associated with this pandemic.
I thought I was showing those to you kind of back channel because he's sort of a dragon in the path as a Western philosopher who is expressing questions that are not in the mainstream. That first question you asked, how is it we as a whole society on us, you know, have made this transition the way we have? I think that's an interesting question in a lot of, and for me, it kind of shows stuff that's been submerged that now has come to the surface, or maybe the water is evaporated and now the mountains of the have become the new benchmark of elevation. I don't know. But how is it that he's saying Italy. In America, that isn't exactly playing out. Where now we're starting to see this bedrock of dissent and of people saying, hell no, I don't want to, you know, don't tread on me. I don't want to be cooped up inside and virus is a conspiracy. I don't know what the whole philosophy is, but it's sort of like how this brings out the nature of crowds and the assumptions of the society. Also, he refers to Ivan Illich, who was a profound critic of both the professional classes as being so over-specialized in a way from their roots in humanity that they became crippling. And he focused particularly on, the Agamben things are also on, the ones I posted are on Medium. Fourth, that I've seen recently, they're very short, and he's usually very hard to read, and these are less hard, kind of speaking to the people. He has a piece called Rec for Students, where he is all against education by Canvas, the learning system, or Zoom, or whatever virtual system is replacing, people talking to people face to face, which I think is part of this phenomenon we're seeing, that the virtual world is now being hastened by virtue of the coronavirus pandemic. In a way that was kind of, on one hand, really unforeseeable, But on the other hand, bringing out some of the best and the worst of what you might call computer culture. So for those who are listening and want to look it up, Giorgio Agamben's last name is A-G-A-M-B-N, Italian philosopher.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. There's been, I've been hearing some similar thoughts to that here in the U.S. I realized that that was Italy and that they had a different situation. But actually, it's more controversial here, I think, than it was there. I mean, he was swimming upstream, but not many people were. But here you have people who are really in contention in a big way over this question about whether we should isolate. I know that there were a number of people who were sort of beside themselves about the problem, the economic problems that were associated with the pandemic that they felt were being caused by lockdowns and isolation. Yeah. Yeah. And then there was a debate with people on the other side who felt that if we didn't lock down, that we would have an even worse economic outcome later on.
Yeah.
And this isn't completely relevant to the conversation that we were having about mindfulness and equanimity. But I do think that it it gets to the point of the kind of unsettled situation that we have, where people are experiencing a lot of anxiety. And, you know, to me, like, the word dukkha, which is the word that is translated as suffering, suffering for some people, maybe it might be overstating what it means, but just anxiety at various levels is suffering in the sense of dukkha. And it's something that we can address through a practice that helps us to understand our thoughts and our emotions and be mindful of them.
Right. Thank you for rescuing me from my a response to your question with a grand leer. You kind of landed. You landed it on all four feet. So just to dot an I or cross a T, this dukkha thing and Buddhism, it's interesting. Jesus essentially wanted all suffering into himself to end it all. That if you come to Jesus, you will be free from suffering. Is that not right?
Yeah. I
say that I'm Jewish and I wasn't trained, you know. I was trained to kind of like not like Jesus, but I do. I mean, he was a Jew. But it may be a different emphasis that Buddha puts on it, but interesting one, which is that, you know, it's like the jogger's mantra. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is extra. Right? Which is where it gets very profound. It's very simple. It's very simple, yet it has such depth. So that we suffer because we attach to things as they is, rather than notice, accept, understand, and let go of them as they arise, manifest, and vanish. And that attaching, that craving to hold, that clinging is, this is where people mistake attachment and desire as, that we shouldn't have desires and that we shouldn't have attachments. Well, you know, a vacuum has attachments, so it's just natural to kind of, you know, want to live and have enough water and shelter and so forth. But the problem is when we, according to the Buddha, that we attach a selfhood to the thing we cling to. And that selfhood is what we think makes it so, and that we continue to believe in it and want to invest in it and prop. And the recognition instead is that, you know, if I see you on Zoom and I say, oh, John's wearing a nice, that's fine. But when I say, and if I go on and say, gee, I wonder where he bought it, then I've started to attach this kind of craving, selfhood to the moment that wasn't there, that I'm bringing to it. And when I recognize that I'm doing that, I recognize the commonality of doing just that in all shapes, sizes, and forms that impede my, you know, living fully for myself and others. And that when I start to see it in myself, this extra suffering on top of the natural pain of being alive and mortal, gosh, I can look at the clip of the print walking down step and see him as an old man who is feeling pain and difficulty as all humans do. And likewise, I can see his contender in a debate or something, and he's lost his train of thought for a moment or whatever. And I don't see necessarily, you know, a president or a vice, you know, or a politician. I see a human being who, all human beings, is given to, you know, getting old and getting sick and dying and not necessarily going through that, you know, happily.
Yeah, who is in probably more pain than most of us.
Yeah.
Gary, do you think some people create their own suffering when there actually is none or little? I see people that are reacting that way to things that I don't think is suffering, but it's obviously painful to them.
You want to give me a for instance before I go with what came up, just so I know we're on the same?
People wearing face masks. I've had people approach me in this little country town nearby as if I was Joseph Stalin. I'm wearing my Joseph Stalin face mask, and they're just, they're apoplectic. Just, what are you doing with that? And it's like,
and they know you.
It's just,
right?
No, they don't know me at all. It's just, they just come up to you on the street.
You look like Joseph Stalin.
Well, I do a bit. You
know, I was going to say.
It's my dark humor there. But you know, it's just the, you know, I'm not suffering from the mask, but they are.
And you're not doing it to them, right? Is what you're, right? Isn't like, you're not responsible for their apoplectic they're responsible for their own mind and their own responses. It's a tricky question, which is why I wanted a for instance, because basically, the Buddhist insight is that we create our own suffering and have the seeds of awakening to that innately within us, which if we water, will liberate us from those seeds of suffering. We're born with both the seeds of suffering, which continue to water, will create cactuses you can't walk through barefoot, or water the seeds of awakening that are also born within us that can recognize, accept, and understand that that's what is going on, then we can live in our heart's garden and invite others. But the tricky part, I think, when I hear this is like, to give an example that's just, you know, on the tip of my tongue, Black Lives Matter. It isn't that Black people have brought on their own suffering. It isn't that it's their karma that they have to work through. That, in other words, there are social causes and conditions that are manifestations of this very nature of suffering, but at a different order of magnitude or scale, so that they're not just individual, they become collective as city councils, neighborhood associations, prejudices, you know, and all those, which kind of like, if I'm born into those things, how do I change those? Because just because I'm living in equanimity and I'm aware that, hey, this is, you know, paradise is now or never. You know, I don't want to wait till I die to see, you know, to see the kingdom of God. On the other hand, there are for whom that's way out of reach of the causes and conditions and the uneven distributions of power and whatnot that have created unnecessary suffering for them from without. So that brings, I guess, me to just answer your questions of what another part of my practice is, which is called engaged practice. And there's social engagement in Buddhism and Christianity. Miss Merton was a great example, which is basically recognizing that the inner and the outer are one, and that when we're dealing with other people who have not yet worked through their stuff, I don't want to live in a world where I'm the only happy person, you know. I would like to help heal and transform these manifestations of suffering that, you know, come up in every day. Your situation, I have no idea yet, you know, what would be a skillful response. But just that question alone, I think, is important.
Well, my response, Gary, to that, I told him, you're welcome. Yeah. He said, what do you mean? I said, I did this for your protection. It's not for mine.
That's right.
And that ended it.
Yeah, so you planted the seed.
Perfect.
Yeah, you know, and something you were saying earlier, it sounds like people and groups also create suffering for others. It's not just self-created suffering.
Yeah. People, corporations, political associations. Yeah. To see those as the same from the get-go as what we were talking about when we began talking about this, but on a different order of scale, becomes very liberating, I think, because then I don't feel like singled out, you know, for, you know, this kind of punishment by ignorance. But I can recognize that the person just doesn't, you know, they don't see the three sides of the triangle as being 180 degrees.
Yeah. Yeah, that's too much like science.
Say what?
Oh, math, doing the math, similar to science. Oh. Some people don't really like the idea of science. I was,
have you noticed?
I was in a disagreement with a guy who considered science to be just another opinion, in effect, you know. And, you know, scientific method involves hypotheses and proofs and that sort of thing, but it's not exactly empiric just research. Opinion, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is one of the problems that we have today is that
exactly
in a divisive and politicized environment as we have now, some people will reject facts that are problematic for them, you know, and these, I think I mentioned earlier that I've had, that I've spent some time on Facebook just trying to present facts or trying to address the factual content of a particular discussion to present the facts against the opinions or the misrepresentations, what I feel are misrepresentations that people are making. But they can come back to me and say, well, those facts are just your opinion. You know, I mean, I have alternate facts. I have a whole different view of things. And it kind of means that there's no authority for reality, really, and that there's no way that you can say that anything is real in a way that everyone will agree to. And I think that that's one of the core problems that we have now is that we have these substantial disagreements about what's real.
Mm-hmm. If you listen to news, it's like reality du jour. It's just, what's the reality today? It may not be the same tomorrow. Don't confuse the issue with facts.
Interesting that to kind of what you're saying, if it furthers the way that we've been talking about that we call a practice. People will often say, well, is this a religion? I say, well, there's no God in it, so I don't know if it's really a religion.
Yeah.
I say, well, is it a philosophy? And you go and say, well, you know, typically philosophy talks about metaphysics, and this is not really metaphysical, and the various criteria which it is and isn't. And you run through the list of categories, and one is education. It's kind of an educational system. But the one that's also really interesting to me is that this way of mindfulness is a science. And it's a discipline of seeing for yourself. It's kind of empirical in that way. You see results, except that what it does, that science, it does a couple of things that Western science doesn't, which is one of which is it includes the self. It includes the experimenter performing the test as part of the test, which Western science is just beginning to get around to accepting, but still has these problems with what they call the hard problem of consciousness. And if you try to deal with the universe without talking about consciousness, you know, you can get really isolated and remote from what you're talking about in the first place and just be kind of lost in this maze of stickers and tabs that you've put on top of things and keep breaking everything down and then further. But Western science is kind of along. You know, you've heard the I think Plutopians have heard the, you know, confluences between Tao and physics and whatnot. So it's interesting that what we call science isn't necessarily, you know, we don't agree on what we call science, right? And I think one reason for it personally is that computer culture has created this long tail where every facet of the crystal is kind of equidistant from each other, and there's no longer a central trunk and roots and branches. It's silicon crystal, as is a virus. And so it becomes challenging to say, yes, there are moral truths, right? And people say, well, it's all relative. And say, well, no, it's not all relative. Right. And I think that kind of, you know, ambivalence is comes along with computer culture, and I'm not crazy about it. But I just said two things at once. Point being that I think if you go about your way of being and doing and living in the situation, like where you see some people and they think you're Stalin because you're masked, they say, "Why are you wearing it?" And you say, "For your good." You've looked at the situation in a scientific way, right? Rather than, you know, getting reactive and, you know, they honk their horn, I'm going to honk my horn louder, right? You've looked at it in a scientific way, which is wise and skillful. And skillful means how to ameliorate, if not eliminate, needless suffering.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's what Buddhism is really about, is a cultivation of skills, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, okay, so
skillful means.
This is Buddhist vocabulary. It interests me. It's not just the words. The skill in Buddhism, when we say skill, and all these arts and skills of Buddhism, for many, this in the Sanskrit word upaya, the kind of way of looking at them is that these are like a finger pointing at the moon is not the moon. That on a foggy night, and I want to see full moon, I don't know where it is, and somebody points, it's over there by that hickory tree. And I look and I see, oh, see the glow. And then I can start to, you know where to point my attention. Then I can let go of the finger. It's like the canoe that takes me to the other shore. I park at the shore. I don't carry it on my head as I go around. It's so you don't want to carry their skillful means because you don't get attached to them. So these skillful tools have a kind of a quality that's very neat in that they're very effective. They're very precise and clear and clean cutting, but they're part of the nature of what is. So if I handed you an autumn leaf, and we looked at it together, and then I said, you know, all things are impermanent, we would be using the leaf as a skillful means, and then the takeaway would be for you not to frame the leaf behind us and put it over your study, right?
That makes me think of Dogen's thing about the firewood. When you burn the wood, it becomes ash, but that doesn't mean that ash is the future of wood. Huh. I mean, the ash is the ash and the wood was the wood.
Right. Right.
Well, actually, I think that we are at the end of our hour.
What an hour it's been. Thank
you. It's been a great ride. And I think we're kind of hanging here in such a way that we would love for you to come back again in the future and we can talk some more.
Sure.
All right. Well, thanks, Gary.
My pleasure.
Thanks again,
gentlemen.
Explore Gary's world at garygock.com. His latest book, Pause, Breathe, Smile, is available on amazon.com. You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.